Good afternoon. Thank you for coming to today's Random Review. Thanks, too, to the Corvallis-Benton County Public Library and Friends of the Library for their sponsorship of the Random Review program. And lastly, thank you, Connie, for a very kind, very flattering introduction. I'm not sure I'm worthy of it. In fact, I'm not certain I'm even the best person to be up here today talking to you about my Antonia, and I'll tell you why. When I was doing my graduate work at Oregon State University, I had the great good fortune to take a course in American fiction from Dr. Michael Oriart, distinguished professor of literature, and today also an associate dean in the College of Liberal Arts. I was an older student, and so in the course of my term of study with Mike, we got to be friends. And in later years, I took to popping into his office on occasion when I was on campus. Now, back in the early 80s, my book club read the novel I'll be talking to you about today. So on my next trip to campus, I waltzed into Mike's office and enthusiastically exclaimed, "Mike, my book club read the greatest book, My Antonia." He smiled and gently corrected, "Oh yes, My Antonia." So I'm finding it very ironic that I'm here today talking about a novel that I did not even initially pronounce correctly, even though there is clearly an accent on the first syllable of the word Antonia in every edition of the book ever published. Suffice it to say, it has been a steep learning curve. And I warn you, inevitably, somewhere along the way today, I will revert to Antonia, but now you'll understand that it is from nerves and not ignorance. End of disclaimers. My Antonia was published in 1918, and the legitimate question to ask would be, why was it ever selected for a random review? And I would suggest that there are several viable responses to that question. Author Willa Cather, there she is, my girl Willa, was one of the foremost American authors in the first part of the 20th century. She was so well respected and admired that her photo was on the cover of Time magazine in 1931, the same year that she was named one of America's 12 greatest women. In 1938, she gave this assessment of the novel: "The best thing I've ever done is My Antonia. I feel like I've made a contribution to American letters with that book. It has sold steadily over the years and has never gone out of print, a very unusual occurrence. It holds an important place in American immigrant fiction, tapping into the common sense of America as a mix of rich heritage." And lastly, no less an authority than Mike Oriart has said, "It's an astonishingly artful book with deceptively simple language." I'm going to begin with some biographical information. The purpose for this is best summed up by James Woodruff in his book, Willa Cather, A Literary Life. He wrote, "More than most authors, Cather presents the reader with a chance to compare biographical data with its transmutation into art. I'm hoping that the events of her life that I cover today will resonate when I later address My Antonia, which is highly autobiographical in many respects." Willella Siebert Cather was born in 1873 in Back Creek, Virginia. She was the oldest of seven children and the first female grandchild, with the result that she was incredibly pampered. Her family had farmed in this lush region since the late 1700s. Willa was born just 8 years after the conclusion of the Civil War, and her family was split in two by it. Two uncles fought for the South. A grandmother helped a slave escape. A grandfather was a Union sympathizer. The family was therefore not popular with neighbors, And one winter, when a sheep barn burned under suspicious circumstances, her paternal grandparents, who had already left for the Great Plains, begged her family to join them with the dire warning that the house would probably go next. Consequently, in 1883, when Willa was 9 1/2, her family left for Nebraska, taking nothing with them except her mother's good china wrapped in Confederate bills. Literary trivia, you gotta love it. The move to Nebraska was a crucial event of Cather's life. At first, it was frightening. She was terrified by the vastness, emptiness, and strangeness of the new land, and she remarked that she and her mother both cried for the first year. But it became part of the memory on which she drew for the rest of her life, and she later explained the acclimation process. "The country and I had it out together, and by the end of that first autumn, that shaggy grass country had gripped me with a passion that I have never been able to shake. It has been the happiness and the curse of my life." She gradually began to venture out and meet neighbors from various lands, Bohemians, Scandinavians, French, and Germans. At age 11, she was employed delivering mail to farms in the region, which gave her unparalleled access to the talk and lives of her immigrant neighbors who hung on to their language and customs as long as they could. Unfortunately, Willa's father was not cut out for the rigors of dry land farming in frontier Nebraska, and after 2 years on the open prairie, he moved the family to the nearby town of Red Cloud, population roughly 1,000, to become an insurance agent. Red Cloud became the model for all the small towns in her novels. They have different names, but all are Red Cloud in disguise. The Cather home was very crowded. In addition to her parents and their 7 children, the household included a grandmother and a cousin. Willa was the only child to have her own room, a small attic room which she cherished. She concluded that she did not ever want to lead a life like her mother, whom she described as always pregnant. In a 1921 interview, Cather commented, "The years 8 to 15 are particularly formative in any author's life. For her, it was the experience of moving to Nebraska and absorbing its pioneer culture that first inspired her as a writer and gave us My Antonia." At age 16, Willa left Red Cloud to attend the University of Nebraska in Lincoln. She initially was a science major with the intention of becoming a doctor. But during her freshman year, an essay she had written on Thomas Carlyle was published in a local newspaper. She said, "What youthful vanity can be unaffected by the sight of itself in print?" The effect was hypnotic. She changed her major to humanities and pursued coursework in Greek, Latin, rhetoric, and literature classes. Willa left Lincoln in 1896 to take a job in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, editing a small ladies' magazine, The Home Monthly. It wasn't particularly satisfying, but it did pay the bills. She was delighted when the door to the society of the rich and privileged opened to her in the person of Isabel McClung, a prominent local socialite and daughter of a judge. The family invited Willa to move into their home, where she was given a small room in which to write. And I would add that the McClung home is in a section of Pittsburgh known as East Liberty. And I'm actually from Pittsburgh myself, and my maternal grandmother and great-grandparents lived in East Liberty. And although we moved when I was 5, I distinctly remember my great-grandparents' home that looked very similar to that. So this is familiar stomping grounds for me. Isabel was to become the enduring influence in Willa's emotional life. The two women traveled to Europe together in 1902, the first of many trips to Europe for Willa. She said that she wrote all of her novels for Isabel, but since both women burned their letters, their relationship to this day remains mysterious. By 1903, she was beginning to be published. Her second book, a collection of short stories, caught the attention of S.S. McClure, editor and owner of the prominent McClure's Magazine in New York City. Impressed with her talent, he offered her a job that necessitated her leaving Pittsburgh, her comfortable life, Isabel, and her family. For six years, Willa gave her all to McClure's, helping make it one of the most profitable and exciting magazines in the world. She was fiction and poetry editor and published many of her own pieces. Her years at McClure's comprised her apprenticeship, and she became arguably the foremost woman in American journalism. She loved the power of the job, but felt trapped by it, describing it as, "Editing a magazine is like going around the world on a fast train, but never getting off to see anything." In 1912, in response to a largely unsuccessful first novel, Alexander's Bridge, Willa experienced a breakthrough. She received a letter from Maine short story writer Sarah Orne Jewett, who wrote, "You must find a quiet place. You must find your own quiet center of life and write from that. In other words, stop imitating other authors and take the leap." After a rejuvenating trip out west, Cather returned to New York, left McClure's, and for the first time in her life, she was working for herself. She began her second novel, O Pioneers, which was published in 1913. With this novel, Willa found her voice. In 1914, she met Swedish opera singer Olof Fremsted, whose struggle to become an artist inspired Song of the Lark, which was published in 1915. Willa was still enjoying the chorus of praise that greeted Song of the Lark when she lost her muse. Isabel announced her engagement to German concert violinist Jan Hamburg, and she subsequently married him in 1916. It was a devastating loss, and while Willa accepted the marriage because she didn't want her relationship with Isabel to end, it is questionable whether she ever really got over it. She left New York City and traveled back to Red Cloud, where she spent several months. She took a trip out into the country to see an old friend, Annie Pavelka, who became the inspiration for Antonia. She returned to New York with only a few short stories to show for her efforts in 1916, but with the idea for Antonia firmly in mind. As she explained to a friend, "I want my next heroine to be like this, like a rare object in the middle of a table which one may examine from all sides." She wrote the book in 17 months and the critics loved it. H.L. Mencken wrote, "I know of no novel that makes the remote folks of the western prairies more real than my Antonia, and I know of none that make them better worth knowing." Willa's next novel, One of Ours, published in 1923, won the Pulitzer Prize and became her first bestseller. Later well-known novels include The Professor's House, Death Comes for the Archbishop, and Shadows on the Rock. In all, she published 13 novels and 6 collections of shorter works. Throughout her career, she remained wildly popular with the public and was one of only a handful of American authors who was both a popular success in her time as well as a great artist. In April 1947, at age 73, Willa died of a cerebral hemorrhage. She was buried in Jaffrey, New Hampshire, where she spent many happy summers and where she wrote sections of My Antonia. On her tombstone is a quote from My Antonia, "That is happiness, to be dissolved and become part of something complete and great." She is remembered as the only American author to truly embody the pioneer aesthetic and turn it into an art form. My Antonia is the third novel in what is known as the Nebraska Trilogy. And when I began to prepare for today's talk, I found it really helpful to read these other two novels. And while I don't have time to go into them in great detail, let me give you just a little thumbnail sketch of both. Old Pioneers is the story of the heroic and headstrong Alexandra Bergson, who comes to the Nebraska prairie as a girl and grows up to make her family's holdings the most prosperous in the region. It received rave reviews, with one critic exulting, "Here at last is an American novel redolent of the Western prairie." It is important in that the major themes of all of Cather's immigrant novels are introduced here, including the beauty and nobility of the prairie and the brave, enduring foreigners who suffer to farm it. In Song of the Lark, Cather takes a hard look at what it takes for a female artist to emerge from the constrictions of small-town Western society. The ambitious and resourceful Thea Kronborg pursues her career as a singer despite a disapproving family and ultimately achieves success on the stage of the Metropolitan Opera in New York City. Although Cather herself was not a musician, the portions of the novel covering childhood, apprenticeship, and artistic awakening in the Western landscape are frankly autobiographical. And now we get to My Antonia. Just out of curiosity, how many of you have read this book at some point? Whoa! I am talking to an educated audience. I better be in top form. Over the years, My Antonia has received near universal acclaim from critics and readers alike. It has stood the test of time so much so that it has been a staple of the eighth grade curriculum in our very own Corvallis School District for decades. In the past few weeks, I've had the opportunity to talk with several 509J graduates, former students, all of whom read My Antonia in eighth grade. After establishing that they had, in fact, read the novel, I asked them what they remembered. Their responses are telling. Julia, the flowery language. Katie, tentatively. Isn't it a novel about unrequited love? Very good guess. Joe, who's at the back of the room. The cover. Blue sky, golden wheat, and a girl in a gingham dress with a white apron. Sarah, the red grass. Deborah, emphatically, the red grass. Deb actually went on to say, "It's the prevalent visual information from the story. It's the image that stuck. The landscape is the most memorable part of the book." So there you have it, the scoop on Antonia from prominent local critics. Am I done? I think not. My Antonia begins with a short introduction that I'll address a little later, followed by five books or sections. Cather worked closely with illustrator W.T. Benda, who designed black and white drawings to be placed throughout the text. There is one at the beginning of each of the five books, as well as several more placed within the text. This is the illustration for book one, which is titled The Shimerdas. It's the longest section, comprising nearly 40% of the book. It opens with a migration that resembles a decisive event of Cather's own childhood. 10-year-old Jim Burden, recently orphaned, moves from Virginia to his grandparents' Nebraska homestead outside Blackhawk, a thinly veiled Red Cloud. The Shimerdas, a family of immigrants from Bohemia, today the Czech Republic, are traveling to Blackhawk on the same train, and the conductor provides us our first glimpse of Antonia, pointing her out as the spokesperson for the family and describing her as bright as a new dollar. Jim goes to his grandparents' white frame farmhouse. but the Shimerdas settle in a rough sod dugout on adjoining land. Antonia, at 14, is 4 years older than Jim and eager to learn English. She befriends him, and together they explore and become familiar with the windswept prairie. While they draw close together and share adventures, there is always a dawning awareness of the gender and class differences that will divide them as they grow up. The Shimerdas struggle in their new environment. They are ill-equipped for the first winter, and Mr. Shimerda, who is intensely homesick for the community and culture of the old country, commits suicide. Fiercely determined to survive, Mrs. Shimerda, a boastful and cantankerous woman, and her combative older son, Ambrose, cultivate the land. Jim attends school, but Antonia stays behind and works in the fields. They are still close friends when, at the end of book one, they are watching an electrical storm from the barn roof. Jim waxes sentimental, as he is prone to do, but Antonia brings him down to earth with a prophetic comment, "Things will be easy for you, but they will be hard for us." Book two, titled The Hired Girls, is titled The Hired Girls and begins with Jim and his grandparents moving into Black Hawk. Shortly thereafter, Antonia also comes to town to work for the burdens of affluent next-door neighbors, the Harlings. Termed a hired girl, she is in fact a maid or servant, but she's well-suited to the job because she's a hard worker and enjoys the various domestic chores. Jim is delighted with her arrival, commenting, "How good it was to have Antonia near us again, to see her every day and almost every night." Antonia is joined in town by other immigrant girls, including Lena Lingard. They're both Scandinavian. Lena Lingard, who's apprenticed to the local dressmaker, and Tiny Soderball, who will work at Mrs. Gardner's boarding house. Antonia is very well liked by the Harling family, but circumstances change radically with the arrival in town of the Vanny's dance tent, where dances are held each Saturday evening. Antonia attends them all and becomes immensely popular, but the attention she receives begins to damage her reputation, and the Harlings insist that she stop going to the dances. Ever headstrong, Antonia refuses and is dismissed, whereupon she goes to work for Wick Cutter, Black Hawk's unscrupulous moneylender. She begins to date Larry Donovan, who works for the railroad as a conductor and is described as a professional ladies' man. Jim socializes more and more with Antonia and her friends, preferring their lively company to that of the stiff town girls. This section of the book ends with an unpleasant episode when Antonia asks Jim to stay at the Cutter's home in her place while the Cutters are out of town. Wick Cutter returns unexpectedly and comes to Antonia's room intending to rape her, and Jim is violently beaten. Three shorter books make up the second half of the novel. In book three, titled Lena Lingard, Jim moves to Lincoln to attend the university. He meets Gaston Cleric, a young Latin scholar, whose inspirational instruction triggers in Jim a period of mental awakening. Lena Lingard arrives in Lincoln to run a dressmaking shop, and she and Jim become frequent companions but maintain what appears to be a platonic relationship. Jim's studies and concentration begin to suffer, with the result that this chapter of Jim's life ends abruptly when Gaston Cleric advises him to, quote, "stop playing about with this handsome Norwegian," unquote, and suggests that Jim follow him to Harvard, where Cleric has been offered a teaching position. Jim goes. Book four, The Pioneer Woman Story, takes place 2 years later when Jim is about to begin law school. He returns to Black Hawk and learns news of the hired girls. While Lena and Tiny go on to become wealthy and respected women in their professions in San Francisco, Antonia has not been so fortunate. Engaged to Larry Donovan, she went to Denver to marry him, only to be deserted. Unmarried and pregnant, she returns home in disgrace. Jim goes to the Shimerda farm, where Antonia is again working hard with her mother and brother, and she has a little daughter, Martha. The two revive their affectionate rapport. The visit ends with Jim promising to return, to which Antonia replies, "Perhaps you will, but even if you don't, you are here, like my father, so I won't be lonesome." In the final segment of the novel, titled Cusack's Boys, Jim returns to Nebraska after a 20-year absence. He now lives in New York City, where he is a successful attorney for a Western Railroad company. He is married to a woman with whom he has little in common and is childless. He visits Antonia at her farmhouse, finding her married to Anton Cusack, a fellow Bohemian whom Jim describes as a most companionable fellow. She has many children, somewhere in the area of 10 or 11. Jim can't figure out quite how many. And she is justifiably proud of the lovely and prosperous farm that she and her husband have created after years of hard work and struggle. He finds her battered but not diminished, a fulfilled and contented woman. He spends a day and night getting to know her children and reminiscing with Antonia. When he leaves, he reflects in the last paragraph of the novel, "I had the sense of coming home to myself and of having found out what a little circle man's experience is. For Antonia and me, this had been the road of destiny, had taken us to those early accidents of fortune which predetermined for us all that we could ever be. Now I understood that the same road was to bring us together again. Whatever we had missed, we possessed together the precious, the incommunicable past." The question now becomes, what does this all add up to? What exactly accounts for my Antonia's tremendous popularity for over 90 years? Why is it such a well-respected novel in the American literary canon? I think there are a number of answers to this question. First, and perhaps foremost, My Antonia is remarkable for its realistic portrayal of the lives of Nebraska homesteaders. The character of Antonia is the embodiment of the westward movement, the pioneer, the symbol of the frontier. Her life is emblematic of the breaking of the sod, the cultivation of the wilderness, and the migration of peoples from the old world to the new. Cather communicates these ideas in several ways. For one thing, there are glorious descriptions of the landscape, its vastness and beauty. When Jim first arrives in Nebraska late at night and is being transported to his grandparents' farm in a rustic wagon, he peers over the side of the wagon and observes, "There seemed to be nothing to see, no fences, no creeks or trees, no hills or fields. There was nothing but land, no country at all, but the material out of which countries are made." A little further along in the journey, he comments, "Between that earth and that sky, I felt erased, blotted out." The next morning, he races outdoors and discovers the ubiquitous red grass. Everywhere, as far as the eye could reach, there was nothing but rough, shaggy red grass, most of it as tall as I. As I looked about me, I felt that the grass was the country, as the water is the sea. This sense of being obliterated by the vast landscape remains strong in his early days in Nebraska and mirrors Willa's own early struggle to come to terms with her new surroundings. Within a short period of time, however, as Jim sits in his grandmother's garden in the sunshine one afternoon, he comes to accept the power of the land over him. "I was entirely happy. Perhaps we feel like that when we die and become a part of something entire. That is happiness, to be dissolved into something complete and great." Does anyone remember where you've heard this quote before? Where? somebody gets an A+. Another technique that Willa employs is to establish Antonia as a young woman who is one with the land, much like Alexandra Berkson in O Pioneers. She doesn't mind missing school to stay home on the farm working in the fields. In fact, she takes great pride in her work and in her physical strength. "Oh, better I like to work out of doors than in a house," she used to sing joyfully. "I don't care that your grandmother say it make me like a man. I like to be like a man." She would toss her head and ask me to feel the muscle swell in her brown arm. In an incident that clearly underscores her instinctive understanding of nature occurs in the first autumn when Jim and Antonia are having a reading lesson out of doors. All the buzzing insects have died but one, a tiny green insect that they observe hopping about feebly. Antonia makes a warm nest for it in her hands, and very soon it begins to chirp. She essentially brings the little creature back to life. At the end of the novel, when Jim visits Antonia on her farm, she is showing him her orchard, which she has struggled for years to establish and is now the finest orchard in the region. She says of the fruit trees, which she has so carefully tended, "I love them as if they were people." Perhaps the novel's most iconic image, epitomizing the westward movement, is presented near the end of The Hired Girls. Jim, Antonia, Teeny, Tiny, and Lena are picnicking at the nearby river. As the sun begins to set, they witness this scene. A great black figure appeared on the face of the sun. We sprang to our feet, straining our eyes toward it. In a moment, we realized what it was. On some upland farm, a plow had been left standing in the field. Magnified across the distance by the horizontal light, it stood out against the sun, the handle, the tongue, the share, black against the molten red. There it was, heroic in size, a picture writing on the sun. As a symbol of the westward movement, the plow stands for the farming frontier, which had only recently supplanted the earlier frontiers of the trapper and miner. Cather has been accused of resorting to heroic idealism in this passage, but one critic has countered that the famous image of the plow is anything but romantic when taken in the context of Antonia's difficult life. Throughout the novel, Cather presents the frontier that Jim and Antonia share as a kind of Eden, and as the narrator, Jim's memories are golden ones. In a novel laden with nostalgia and longing for the past, Cather avoids sentimentality by employing the juxtaposition of contrasts. In this case, good and evil are alternated. The idyll of Jim's boyhood is punctuated by sterner realities, such as Mr. Shimerda's suicide. Another example is the rattlesnake incident. One afternoon, Jim and Antonia are at the nearby prairie dog town trying to determine whether the holes run straight down or horizontal. It's just an adorable little picture. Jim nearly backs into a huge rattlesnake before Antonia warns him with a terrified scream. Without thinking, Jim runs at it and kills it with a spade that he happens to have in his hand. It turns out to be the largest snake ever killed in the region, 5.5 feet in length. And Jim observes, he seemed like the ancient eldest evil. Another more horrifying example of Cather's use of artistic contrast is a story told by Russian neighbors Peter and Pavel. Back in Russia, they had attended a winter wedding out in the country. After much merriment and more than a little drink, six sleighs begin the late-night return trip to town, only to be attacked by a pack of hungry wolves. One by one, the sleds are overturned and the wedding guests killed. Finally, Peter and Pavel's sleigh is the last one left, and to save themselves, they throw the other occupants, the bride and groom, out of the sled. The episode forced them to flee their homeland. This tale in particular vividly illustrates the violent underside of the wilderness experience, as well as the dark pasts that many American settlers left behind. There are other examples: Wick Cutter's Devil Trees, the meanness of Antonia's older brother Ambrose, the seduction and abandonment of Antonia by Larry Donovan. The cruel and ugly scenes and characters balance nicely the pleasant memories. The wonderful first autumn, Jim's happy first Christmas, Mrs. Harling's cheerful household, the picnic, the exhilarating talks of Gaston Cleric, and Jim's final visit to Antonia's farm. Next, I'd like to turn to the narrative structure of the book. Catherine made the decision to use the first-person point of view and selected Jim as the narrator. She believed that novels of feeling, such as My Antonia, are best narrated by a character in the story, as opposed to stories of action, which are best told by a third-person omniscient narrator. She had been using male narrators in her short fiction for some time, so there was no novelty in this choice. Moreover, Cather explained that much of what she knew about Annie Pavelka, the Bohemian immigrant on whom she based Antonia, she had learned from talks with men who had been fascinated by Annie and spent time with her whenever they could. This was when they were young. The novel begins with an epigraph taken from Virgil, Optima dies prima fugit, which means the best days are the first to flee. It epitomizes the elegiac tone of the novel and provides the major recurring theme. Time and again, Jim reflects nostalgically on the past. He has chosen to give an oration at his high school commencement, and afterwards, Antonia gives him a congratulatory hug. He comments, "I have had no success that pulled at my heartstrings like that one." He looks back at his first year in Lincoln as one of the happiest of my life. And during his visit to Antonia in book four, they are walking through the fields together, and he thinks to himself, "I felt the old pull of the earth. I wished I could be a little boy again." Jim has always loved Antonia, but will end up far away from her in a life distant from the one they shared as children. Many critics believe that the emotional experience when Cather's close friend Isabel McClung married underlies the sense of thwarted longing in the novel. The epigraph also explains the way the book unfolds. It is episodic rather than plot-driven. This structure is reinforced in the introduction, which frames the novel with a conversation between the adult Jim Burden and an anonymous I character whom we can presume to be Willa Cather. In a chance meeting on a train crossing Iowa, quote, "our talk kept returning to a central figure, a Bohemian girl whom we had both known long ago," unquote. Jim tells his traveling companion, i.e. Cather, that he has been writing down his memories of Antonia, and several months later, he appears in Cather's apartment in New York City with a completed manuscript. He explains that he has not taken time to arrange it. Rather, he simply wrote down everything that her name recalls. It is, he says, without form or title. Cather's decision to avoid any formal structure results in a series of everyday happenings which comprise the events that make up the bulk of most people's lives. There would be no dramatic love affair, courtship, marriage, or broken heart. The result is a novel that gives the impression of a real autobiography rather than fiction. And since the narrator is not a professional author, the apparent artlessness of the novel seems perfectly logical. Note, apparent artlessness. The novel, then, does not give us the stories of Jim and Antonia's lives. Rather, since Jim's memories shape the narrative, it's about the meaning of Antonia to a man whose happiest days were those of his youth and who, in the last book, becomes reconciled to the present. For me, one of the most compelling facets of the book is the strength of the characterization. And if you're wondering what this slide has to do with characterization, the answer is none. You try finding a slide that screams characterization. Now, you've already heard a lot about Jim and Antonia, but there are numerous minor characters whom we might recognize and who are colorfully presented. For example, here's a description of Wick Cutter, Black Hawk's unsavory money lender. He was an inveterate gambler, though a poor loser. He was full of moral maxims for boys. I detested his pink bald head and his yellow whiskers, always soft and gleaming. It was said he brushed them every night as a woman does her hair. His white teeth looked factory made. He was notoriously dissolute with women. Two Swedish girls who had lived in his house were the worse for the experience. And then there is this picture of Mrs. Cutter. He had certainly met his match when he married Mrs. Cutter. She was a terrifying-looking person, almost a giantess in height. Her teeth were long and curved, like a horse's. People said babies always cried if she smiled at them. Her face had a kind of fascination for me. It was the very color and shape of anger. The very color and shape of anger. I think that is just amazing writing. More flattering in nature are descriptions of characters like Mrs. Harling, who was modeled after Willa's Red Cloud neighbor, Mrs. Julia Minor. Mrs. Minor died while Willa was writing My Antonia, and in a letter to one of the Minor daughters, Carrie, she wrote that she had tried hard to recall certain tricks of voice and gesture in creating Mrs. Harling. In the novel, she is described as short and square and sturdy looking, like her house. Every inch of her was charged with an energy that made itself felt the moment she entered the room. Her face was rosy and solid, with bright twinkling eyes and a stubborn little chin. She was quick to anger, quick to laughter, and jolly from the depths of her soul. She sounds to me like Mrs. Santa Claus. Another set of characters that Catherine develops with tremendous skill are the hired girls, who contrast vividly with the American farm and town girls. All the farmers, whether American-born or foreign, were hard-pressed, but no self-respecting American farmer would let his daughter hire out as a servant. The Bohemian and Scandinavian girls had no alternative, and the girls are determined to find employment of some kind to help clear the homestead from debt. As hired girls in the homes of the more affluent families in town, they work hard to earn money and send all of it home. Jim notes, "The girls I knew were always helping to pay for plows and reapers, brood sows and steers to fatten." The outcome of this phenomenon is an interesting one. One result of this family solidarity was that foreign farmers in our county were the first to become prosperous. After the fathers were out of debt, the daughters married the sons of neighbors, usually of like nationality. And the girls who once worked in Black Hawk kitchens are today managing big farms and fine families of their own. Their children are better off than the children of the town women they used to serve. Not all the hired girls are fortunate. They are all vulnerable to sexual betrayal, scandal, and censure. And it's already been noted that Wick Cutter impregnated several Scandinavian girls in his employ. In an interesting twist of fate, Antonia reveals at the picnic that her mother had been a hired girl in her father's home back in Bohemia and explains, "He could have paid my mother and not married her, but he was too kind to treat her like that." Along with all the young men in Black Hawk, Jim finds the hired girls immensely more appealing than the American-born town girls. As the oldest girls on the new farms, the immigrant girls have experienced hard physical labor, and have learned much from life, poverty, their mothers, and grandmothers. Jim describes them vividly. Physically, they were almost a race apart, and out-of-doors work had given them a vigor which made them conspicuous among Black Hawk women. In contrast, the American-born girls stay indoors, and in one of my very favorite passages in the book, Jim writes, "When one danced with them, their bodies never moved inside their clothes. Their muscles seemed to ask but one thing, not to be disturbed." Again, that is just such incredible writing. The last topic that we'll have time to touch on is sexuality. The characters of Jim, Antonia, and Lita provide three starkly contrasting models. Jim is essentially sexless, dried up, desiccated, a detached intellectual whose aversion to all things sexual is explicit in the novel. James Woodruff, in his biography of Cather, A Literary Life, argues that Jim represents the yearning for the pre-puberty years of sexual innocence. Cather recalled the days when she played with her younger brothers, unaware of sexual differences, as times of golden memory. Jim shares this feeling in his memories of his idyllic months of childhood with Antonia. His adult life, however, is impoverished by Cather's bias against romantic love. Woodruff writes, quote, "Her greatest failing as an artist is her inability to depict heterosexual adult relationships affirmatively," unquote. As a celibate writer herself, she gives Jim her own aversion to sex, and when he marries, she gives him a frigid, unhappy marriage. During his final visit to Antonia on her farm, he muses on the differences between Antonia and her husband. "I wondered whether the life that was right for one is ever right for two." Jim's aversion to sex is developed in scenes such as the rattlesnake killing, an obvious sex symbol, and an incident that physically sickened him. Later, in the attempted rape by Wick Cutter, he feels repelled and defiled, and he hates Antonia for involving him in this tawdry episode. Jim does have a sexual awakening of sorts, but it is only in his dreams. He has a recurring dream about Lena, in which she approaches him in a short skirt, flushed like the dawn, with a kind of luminous rosiness all about her. "She sat down just beside me, turned to me with a soft sigh, and said, 'Now they are all gone, and I can kiss you as much as I like.' I used to wish I could have this flattering dream about Antonia, but I never did." Antonia is off limits to Jim, and for good reason. She is the fecund earth goddess figure, hardly compatible with an asexual childhood friend. The one time Jim kisses her after one of the Saturday night dances, she rejects his overture with a horrified, "You know it ain't right to kiss me like that." Jim observes dryly that she'll probably always view him as a kid, and Antonia agrees, "I expect I will, but you're a kid I'm awfully fond of." Antonia is representative of fertility, the apotheosis of the Earth Mother, and as such is an incarnation of the Greek goddess Persephone, goddess of springtime and rebirth. She is well suited to this role, as is made abundantly clear in the final book, Cusack's Boys. In an iconic scene, Antonia and her children proudly show Jim their new fruit cave, recently excavated and now filled with glass jars of fruit and barrels of pickles. Their entrance is described with the words, "When we descended," calling up the descent of Persephone to Hades. After he and Antonia emerge, the children, quote, "all came running up the steps together, big and little, towheads and gold heads and brown, and flashing little naked legs. It was a veritable explosion of life, out of the dark cave into the sunlight. Dark cave to sunlight, womb to birth, Hades to earth. The connections are very clear. Later, Jim raises Antonia to the heroic status of mother of the races. It was no wonder her son stood tall and straight. She was a rich mine of life, like the founder of early races. Her marriage to Cusack, whom she cares for like one of her children, is not a love match, but a comfortable arrangement for getting offspring into the world, as suggested by Jim's comment. It did rather seem to me that Cusack had been made the instrument of Antonia's special mission. Lastly, there is Lena, who is described by critic Merrily Lindemann as a Scandinavian Marilyn Monroe. Need I say more? I do. In our first image of her, Lena is knitting as she watches over her father's cattle herd. And while she is scantily clad, as many of the immigrant girls were in their early days on the prairie, because they all had only one dress to their name, the extreme fairness of Lena's skin, quote, somehow made her seem more undressed than the other girls who went scantily clad, unquote. From early on, she is talked about, as Antonia terms it. She is accused of making her elderly neighbor, Ole Benson, lose what little sense he has, so besotted is he by her beauty and sexiness. When Jim is rebuffed by Antonia when he kisses her, Jim explains that Lena lets him kiss her. Antonia retorts, Lena's all right, only, well, you know yourself, she's soft that way. She can't help it. It's natural to her. Jim lingers over the details of Lena's physicality, describing the miraculous whiteness of her skin, the swelling lines of her figure, her sleepy violet eyes, and soft, undulating walk. Unlike Antonia, the Earth Mother, Lena decries the institution of marriage in language very similar to Cather's own views on marriage. Declares Lena, I've seen a good deal of married life, and I don't care for it. Jim further recounts, she remembered home as a place where there were always too many children, a cross man, and work piling up around a sick woman. They part in Lincoln with a slow renunciatory kiss, and Jim observes, she always kissed one as if she were sadly and wisely sending one away forever. Lena disappears almost entirely from the narrative after this point. Antonia, on the other hand, returns as the central character in both of the final two sections. It has been suggested by Mike Oriard that by leaving the land and migrating to increasingly larger cities, Lena loses the rootedness, that connection to the land that Antonia represents. And it is by visiting Antonia on her farm that Jim is reconnected to the land and finds what he has been searching for, that sense of coming home to himself. In summary, the heart of My Antonia is a remarkable lifelong friendship between a man and a woman of different cultures and classes, a childhood affection that helps the adult Jim and Antonia reconcile themselves to the past. You really are a part of me, Jim confesses, to which Antonia replies, ain't it wonderful, Jim, how much people can mean to each other? I'm so glad we had each other when we were little. So, thank you. I didn't leave time for questions and comments, but if you want to stay after, I would certainly be happy to hear from you, all of you. Thank you. You've been a wonderful audience. I certainly appreciate your attention and your numbers.